Really, Mr. Reed, there isn't anything to worry about. After all, it was only a slap.
That's exactly what I told Mr. Reed. But he insisted upon remaining home from business to talk to you, Miss Callahan.
Well, I know it may seem stupid of me, but it's not the slap I'm worried about. It's the reason.
Something to do with a butterfly. They were quarreling about it.
No. Amy slapped Donald because he hurt the butterfly, and it was her friend.
Well, that seems a harmless fancy.
Amy has too many fancies and too few friends, and it worries me. It doesn't seem normal.
You know these fond fathers with their only chicks.
I can see that you're worried, Mr. Reed. And Amy is a very sensitive and delicately adjusted child. But part of the blame for that may lie with you. Perhaps you're over-anxious. Watch her too closely. Worry too much. The child's bound to feel it.
It's late, Mommy. You haven't forgotten my birthday party.
No, darling.
Your birthday, Amy. And I have something for you in my locker. A present.
Mommy's having a party for me, and I invited Robert and Lois.
Amy and I'll meet you at the car.
And Evelyn and Daddy and Dick and Robert.
Oh, look at these, Ollie. Aren't they cute? There must be one of Amy's here. Oh, here it is. She certainly doesn't seem to have inherited any artistic abilities from either of us.
Well, it shows imagination anyhow.
I wonder if you don't resent that in her.
I'm sure I don't, Alice. It's something else. Something moody. Something sickly. She could almost be Irena's child.
You've landed on The Substance, a podcast aimed at being biblical, thoughtful, and human. Join us here every other week as we engage the culture without the culture war. I'm your host, Philip Marinellos, saying, hope you guys all have a good new year. There's a chance that you'll be hearing this actually before the new year, so if that's the case, we got it in. We got our Christmas episode in, Christmas movie episode in, rather. 2023, heck of a year. Excited for the new year here, both personally. Some great things going on in the community, some encouraging things, as well as with the show here. So it's been a pleasure to do. Grateful for you guys who keep listening, keep downloading, keep sharing. If you like the show, reminder to hit the 5-star button on Apple, Spotify, whatever that takes ratings. If you're on Apple, write us a sentence or two. We always love that. But yeah, we're glad you joined us here. The Substance, we are a Christian variety show. Every other week, we invite somebody who is smart, interesting, capable, doing good work in a field that we admire on. And we talk about things related to faith and culture and the arts. Previous guests include folks like Film Spotting's Josh Larson, Sarah Welch Larson, no relation, formerly of the Seeing and Believing podcast, now the Seeing and Believing Substack, now New York Times film critic Alyssa Wilkinson, and our buddies over at Letterboxd, Slim and Mitchell. So got a lot of great shows if you're into the films, but we have a whole library of all sorts of great stuff. Check that out if you're new to the show. And on this episode, we welcome Stephanie Stalvey back to the show. Stephanie is an artist. A lot of you may have seen her work on Instagram. She has been kind of working on a webcomic that's turning into a graphic novel. We talked about that a little bit when we had her on for the initial episode on 1942's Cat People. We're here on this episode for 1944's Curse of the Cat People. Two very substantive movies that I did not have very high hopes for at all when I first saw them, especially the second one. So Cat People knocked my socks off. That was a surprise. But then the second one, I'm like, Curse of the Cat People. I know it was made because the studio's like, the first one made a lot of money. Here's the title. Go with it. So I did not have very high hopes for it, but this one ended up really surprising me. And it ended up being a little bit of a Christmas movie too. So that was great. It was fun to talk with Stephanie about the parallels to the original film, as well as how this did new things. So if you're like almost everybody and you have not seen this movie previously, I'm going to include a link in the show notes. There's a wonderful high resolution version of the film that is free. It's a 1080p. It was ripped off the Blu-ray on the Internet Archive. So that is free and legal and legit. I'll put that in the show notes. So if you haven't seen Curse of the Cat People, and you would like to do that before you watch this movie, that is a great link to do that. So if you haven't seen it, pause, check it out. It's like 70 minutes, maybe as long as this podcast itself. So check it out. come back to the show and enjoy. And here's my conversation with artist Stephanie Stalvey on the 1944 film, The Curse of the Cat People. Stephanie Stalvey, welcome back to The Substance.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be back.
This is exciting. It's always nice to have repeat guests, but it's really fun. I had no expectations of the first Cat People movie when I watched it to have Josh Larson on the show to just talk about horror in general. But I ended up loving it. You graciously said yes the first time. And then as I continued to watch, I was like, oh my goodness, like Curse of the Cat People is kind of a Christmas movie here.
Yeah. Yeah, and we did it. We watched it like on brand on Halloween and then on Christmas. So we really got the spirit of the thing both times.
No, and I love finding something that, like, this was very unexpected for me. Like, I watch all sorts of movies. I love old movies, and I didn't even realize the first one was in the Criterion Collection, but these movies are wonderful, and I've got a whole little list of the producer who made these and the director who made the first one. Like, I've got a whole little watch list going from these two films here.
Oh, you'll have to share that with me. Yeah, because also, I had never heard of Cat People until you brought it up to me, and I was instantly obsessed with it. So I'm really excited to talk about the second one, too.
So The Curse of the Cat People came out a couple years later in 1944. Synopsis reads, Amy, the young, friendless daughter of Oliver and Alice Reed, befriends her father's late first wife in an aging, reclusive actress. So kind of vague, kind of interesting, kind of going like,
yeah.
After Cat People, I was like, what is the sequel going to be? Because Irena's gone.
Yeah.
And I mean, there was that other who actually, it is unclear to me if the woman in Curse of the Cat People, who was also in Cat People, if that's the same character of the woman in the restaurant who called her sister.
Oh, yeah.
Who's the daughter.
Like, that obviously just looks like a cat, that woman.
Yeah. So she's in this film.
Yeah.
I'm going with she's the same person.
Sure.
I'm not entirely sure.
I think I found myself trying to make like a lot of connections to the first movie, like at the first half. But then by the second half, I was like, this is a completely different movie. And I think I have to think of them independently because they're so different. You know,
you said you watched the first one twice. How many times did you watch this one?
I just got to watch this one once. Okay.
I kind of went hard on this one. And,
yeah.
And each time I watch it, I like it more. And kind of like, because usually I only watch a movie once or twice for the show. But
yeah,
we thought we were going to record a while ago. I've seen it about three or four times.
Oh, no.
Now. And I've got some ideas, but I want to lead with you. Yeah, it's got a lot of interesting parallels and subversions or twists on themes from the first movie. Whereas the first movie, it's about repression, and Irena meets Oliver, who we were both very surprised. And I imagine a lot of viewers, especially modern viewers looking at a movie in the early 40s about this, Oliver was a very sensitive, like a shockingly sensitive and doing like the thoughtful and the wise and the comforting thing. And on first glance, that is not his role in this movie.
No. In the first movie, Oliver was incredibly chill. He's like, his wife is like, I am neurotic. I have all this anxiety. And he's like, it's fine. And it's going to be fine. And he was like very, very calm. And then this one, he's like, has no chill whatsoever. He's like, my 6-year-old is imagining things.
So in the he is like, the trauma from the first movie, he is living with that. And he has lived with that. He's in his head. Like, he treats Amy as if she was Irena's daughter, kind of in a way. And Alice says the timeline of the first movie is unclear because it's short and there's definitely time jumps. But they were not married for all that long before Irena died at the end of the first film.
It also brought back up that question that we kind of had in the first movie about how much was this real? Like, how much was she actually afflicted by like a supernatural werewolf-like curse where she would like become a cat person? How much of this actually is some kind of psychosis that she's going through? And it was interesting because I found myself asking the same question in the second movie. I thought kind of by the end of the first that we had established it was real all along. You know, she really could transform. She really could become this animal, but it was ambiguous enough that you weren't 100% sure. And then in the second one, the fact that Oliver is so obsessed with whether or not his little girl is like living in a fantasy land or like getting too far away from reality kind of confirmed to me that like, well, why would he care about this if it was like actually like a real thing that happened to them? You know, is he concerned because he knows the danger of like believing in something that's like too far away from reality or too fanciful?
Well, and he's had distance from it too. I do think the first movie, while using shadow and suggestion, it was clear that at least for Irena, there was some sort of supernatural, spiritual connection and transformation there. But in this world, so she died, it's been a while, and Amy was, what, six, you said?
Yeah.
It's been six, seven, 8 years since that. So, like, and Oliver's just Mr. Engineer. So, like, he's,
yeah,
after time, I'm sure he's just kind of like, man, that was a weird thing that happened.
Like, yeah, you would think.
He didn't see the claw marks on the bathing, or the, not the bathing suit, like the bathrobe or whatever. So, like, I don't even remember. It's been a little while since I watched the first one. I don't know how much firsthand stuff Oliver even saw. So like he could be completely convinced that it was all nonsense and just a wild thing.
The only thing I'm thinking of is like the very last scene when they're like, she never lied to us. And they kind of,
yeah,
they find her.
Sure.
Like, oh my God.
It's hard to impose. Like you don't want to impose too much continuity in these old movies. Yeah. I don't think that was exactly their goal, but it's understandable. However, six, seven, 8 years that you could just kind of, it could get kind of hazy. And like that realization he had at the end of like the trust in her, like I'm sure that was a very traumatic, awful thing. Like he loved this woman. He never got to be intimate with her and she died horribly.
Right. Like,
that's got to scar you. And he, in this movie, his arc is him learning to try to not take it out on his daughter.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because like in the first one, we have this, the woman, Irena, is the, you know, kind of like main character, and she has a self-imposed control over an essential part of her, which is like any kind of deep feeling, sexuality, rage, that she's kind of like keeping herself in a cage. And it's interesting because the second movie, the six-year-old girl is the main protagonist of the movie.
Didn't see that coming. Like when, right, I was like, oh, this movie's about a child, and it starts out with,
exactly,
like
the last one playing was sexual.
And like
weird.
Yeah, the first one was about sexual repression, and this is about a child's imagination.
But at the same time, I think that there is some kind of connection too, because we still have this female character who we see at a younger stage, and she's not trying to put these kind of like self-imposed barriers around what she enjoys and the ways in which she's different and her imagination. But now she has it from this outside force, right? So she's her father, in an attempt to like protect her or whatever, is like, this part of you is dangerous, right? The same way that Irena was telling herself, this part of me is dangerous. This little girl's hearing that. Yeah, this is a part of you that you need to shut down or else.
Well, and it's interesting. So the movie starts out with elementary school teacher taking the kids out. And I guess this town is like where the Sleepy Hollow legend originated. That was also an interesting factor. Like the opening, the opening title sequence has like a children's storybook, fantasy, fairy tale kind of imagery.
There's
a little bit of cat, like it's called Curse of the Cat People, just because that was a title that the producers gave them and said, make a sequel. The first one was a runaway hit. Because I was like, Curse of the Cat People, this is kind of nothing. Literally, at the very beginning, you see a black cat in a tree, and like one of the little boys like points an imaginary machine gun at it. And like that's the only cat imagery, really, in the entire movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Literally, you're at the cat very beginning.
In the afterlife.
No.
She's like Glinda the Good Witch.
Very much so. So
yeah.
At the beginning, when they're at the park, one of like the inciting incidents where we kind of get to see kind of how Amy, the little girl's life is, she's just kind of wandering very freely. Well, the kids complain, like, we don't really have fun with her. Like, she doesn't play our games normally. Like, she's not fun. And she's out there like making friends with this butterfly who this little boy, I didn't read it as malicious, who he tries to catch it for her and he ends up killing it. And then she ends up slapping him and doesn't even really get in trouble with the teacher. She gets in trouble with her father.
Yeah. It's also the inadvertently crushing a small animal reminded me of when the bird dies in the first one.
Yes. Yeah. How he's just, he's holding the broken little creature.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I thought that that was kind of cool that she slapped him. She's like, why did you kill this guy, this thing?
Yeah. That's a completely understandable thing. And then another thing, again, how my first thought is to say progressive, but just how thoughtful and open-minded and how not in my mind of the 1940s this was. So at the little parent-teacher conference that basically Oliver, the dad, decides to happen over this slapping incident, he's like, she shouldn't have done this. Like, he's upset. Like, both the mom, Alice from the first movie, who's now his wife, Alice and the teacher are both like, it happens. They're kids. She slapped him because he crushed the butterfly. No big deal. And he goes, no, she's not adjusting properly. And the teacher says to Oliver, perhaps that has to do with you. Maybe you're making her anxious because you watch her too much and have such high expectations for a 6-year-old. And I was like, what? Like, 1944? Like, wow.
Tell him.
That's not like keep your kids in line and like strict disciplinarian. Like, I was kind of stunned in each viewing. I'm like, that's fascinating how these little horror genre fantasy movies, like, they were like really progressive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's jumping ahead a bit too, but I had the same thought when he like finally eventually gets so frustrated with her that he like decides to corporate punish, like spank her.
Oh, gosh. That was brutal.
It rips my heart out, because don't get me started on hitting children. But I do kind of like, I think we have shorthand that it's like, oh, this was so common back in the day that people didn't even think about hitting their kids. But that's not the way that it's portrayed here. It's like extremely solemn.
Well, no, because they said that was the first time.
Afterwards.
Like, he got so worked up. Like, that was the first time that their discipline or punishment or whatever you want to call it got to actually, like, physical discipline.
Yeah.
Because he didn't believe what she was saying about her imaginary friend.
And he breaks their bond by doing that. You know, she's lost his trust and she runs away. But yeah, just to say that I thought that that part, too, was like, no, human beings are human beings. And, you know, the things that we feel morally convicted about, I think, aren't always as different as we want to think they were a couple of generations ago. You know,
well, that is a good point.
There's a lot of familiarity, but it is. I think that we get in our heads like, okay, this was the norm, so this was just how it is. And norms change gradually, but I like having those little moments where I'm surprised by something that feels really familiar, even though it's...
This is 80 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of chronologically, I love how this was like a 70-some minute movie. It was short, but it moved. I wouldn't mind if it had it a little bit more, but like, this was a very full movie.
Oh, yeah.
How about the scene at the beginning where it was so precious? There's so many scenes that the more I watch and chew on them, like, they're very genre and like pulpy, but they're also so heartfelt. Her birthday party, where time kept passing and she was so excited. This little girl is so excited for her birthday party, all of her friends to come over. And like, nobody's coming, nobody's coming, nobody's coming. And they're like, what's going on? So Oliver starts calling all the parents and everybody's like, we didn't get any invitations. And come to find that Amy is like, no, I want to deliver the letters myself. And what she did was she put them in the tree in the backyard because there's a hole in the tree. And when she was like 3 years old, her dad and her pretended that it was a magic mailbox. And she just still was like living in that child fantasy, and then realizing that because of that, nobody's coming to her party. Like, that was it was so beautiful, but also so sad.
Yeah, it was like really heartbreaking. And it was also heartbreaking that he's like, then like blames her about it. Like, did a 6-year old thing.
When the kids are upset, he's like, yeah, I don't blame them. Like, yeah, they're mad. You didn't invite them to your party. And it's like,
yeah.
Guy, this is your little kid.
Exactly.
Who's like enjoying her imaginary life. And I get it. Like, watching this movie as a parent, I'm sure, is a completely different experience than if I watched it 5 or 6 years ago before I had a kid.
All movies are that way.
With, like, it's not wrong to have expectations and I want your kid to succeed and be socialized and all these things, but like you can't put adult expectations on a child. It's impossible.
Exactly. Yeah, she's literally just like this entire movie being like innocent and imaginative, and he's scared for her. And I think that parents, a lot of the time, they do the most damage, not just because they want to be authoritarian, but because they think that they're doing something protective. They think that they're doing what's best, quote unquote, for their child. And I think that that's important to realize too, that we have the best intentions a lot of the time, but slowing down and leading with curiosity and saying, what is this going to mean to my kid? It's probably a good idea.
Absolutely. Like, she was so precious and so yeah. sweet. And like, and this happens a lot. And now as a parent, I'm looking into this and reading up some and just trying to do this right. Like, she was trying to like take care of her dad. She wasn't developing at a normal pace. She was like trying to perform so her dad wouldn't get mad at her.
Yes. Doesn't she say like her mission is to make him happy?
Okay, so I wanted to hit that next. Like, it's a short movie, so like the chronology, yeah. like every scene like leads right into the next one. Like, it's kind of a freight train. It doesn't feel like it goes by in a second, but it's very efficient storytelling. So
yeah.
after they realize nobody's coming, they still have a good time. They still have a party. They have like a servant in their house. Yeah, so they have the cake. She goes to make her wish. And then right away, she tells her dad, like, my wish is to be like a good girl and obey and to make you happy and yes. all these things.
Ooh.
And then the servant goes, oh, you said it. So now it's not going to come true. And like, just this weird, like, it's sad and icky that like, she's using her birthday wish to like, make up for her dad's anxieties. And then the servant is like, well, now you've said it. Now you're not going to be a good girl. Like, but it's still kind of light too. Like, this movie really works very interestingly with tone. And for me, it didn't really miss. Like, it's working with kind of a lot of things all together, but it's still the genre doesn't push it too far for me.
Yeah. That was the moment I think where I made the connection to the first movie, because I think we might have even talked about this, like the true and false self on our first podcast.
Yeah.
Which is, again, the child psychology would have been maybe 10 years later. Donald Winnicott talks about how children need the opportunity to be their true self, and their true self is difficult, and their true self is dysregulated, and they need the opportunity to still know that their parents are going to be safe and regulated and present, even when they're not faking, you know, being okay in their presence. And he talks about how children, in order to survive, will develop a false self where they'll try to suppress anything that's going to displease their parents, because they rely on their parents for survival. And so it's kind of the thing where like the 6-year-old becomes responsible for the 45-year-old man's emotions and managing
that. At the end of that wish, she's like, I can make this happen. Like, I can make myself be a good
something
girl
other than what I am. Ugh. I can make myself something other than what I am so that I can have my dad's approval, because the way that I am, just my true self, isn't making him happy and it isn't acceptable to him. So that has to go underground. Yeah, it's like it hits deep, because I think it's something that each of us experience in some way from, you know, all directions as children and as parents. But I think so often it's that true self part of us that we become convinced when we're little that we need to suppress in order to be loved. It's that part of us that's really beautiful. It's that part of us that's actually good. And we don't get the opportunity to know that. Her imagination, her kind of like whimsical delight, the way that she is different than the other kids, wasn't something that needed to be punished out of her, but it's something that he could have seen as beautiful. And that's where I made the connection to Irina. And I was like, okay, in the first one, we're seeing an adult version of this with her sexuality. This was something that she believed that she needed to exercise out of her in order to be a good person or a good wife, right? And the origins of that, I think, are in childhood, right? When women experience this, my sexuality is the part of me that's bad and needs to go. The origins of that are in childhood, and there's there's something about me that's not good that needs to go.
And I mean, again, I feel like for you, this is like a fastball right down the middle. I was so glad that I was like, initially came on the show, but I was like, I feel like these stories will really resonate with you.
I mean, they really did. They're speaking my language. And I love that too. I think, you know, just like we said, finding these themes that are just human themes. And so they recur. It doesn't matter where we're reading them, if it's like poetry or if it's books or if it's movies or what decade it's in. These are human being things, you know, and that's why we're drawn to them, I think.
Yeah. No, I mean, at this stage in my life, I think I probably would have liked Cat People fine. But post 2020 and post being a parent, like these things really hit you in a different way. And I'm excited for people to find these movies. And hopefully through the show, we can kind of get people to check some of these out. So then Amy is trying to make up with the neighborhood kids. And she goes to see them and they're like, we're mad at you. And they kind of play a trick on her and ditch her. And as she's chasing after them to try to catch up, and just she wants to be friends in that scene to make her dad happy. Like, she feels bad about the party, but she is trying to like be normal. She's trying to like play with these other girls because that's what a normal little girl does, is they play with other girls. Like,
right,
she was happy to like be by herself and read and play around in the garden or whatever, but she's like, my dad wants me to play with other kids, so like I'm gonna go do that.
Yes.
And then the other kids don't let her play with them. So they run away and they ditch her in front of like this old creepy house.
Classic. The witch house on the block.
Yeah. They call it the witch house. They do like one of the little nursery rhymes and run away. And then kind of a, like somewhere between like a sweet and haunting voice comes and is like, little girl, come here. And I was like, uh-oh. Like, is this going to, the first time I saw it, I was like, okay, is this where it gets into the horror? And it doesn't quite get to horror. Like, I would say it's sort of in that genre because of the production and a lot of things, but this isn't, Cat People is definitely like in the horror genre. This is somewhere in the maybe child's fantasy. It's horror adjacent, but it's not anything because it deals with the 6-year-old.
The vibe to me though was that it was horror adjacent because they were like, oh yeah, this has got to be a horror movie. You know, but like,
they're in Sleepy Hollow. So the old lady,
like, why is there Sleepy Hollow in this? That was the part where they're like, okay, we need a creepy old house. We need a creepy old lady. And we need her to tell a scary story. What's a scary story? Sleepy Hollow.
That's scary. That one scene later in the movie, that was legitimately scary. And then
but it wasn't connected to anything that I picked up on. Like, what? Well,
I don't know if there's a thematic. There's two things in this movie.
Okay.
I'll kind of sidebar here. There's two things in the movie that even after like 3.5 viewings, I'm still chewing on.
Okay.
Like, the Sleepy Hollow is one of them. I'm like, is there a connection? And I mean, I know the story, read it forever ago. I saw the cartoon. I saw the Johnny Depp movie, but like, it's not a legend I know intimately. So Sleepy Hollow, I wasn't sure if that connected thematically or not. Maybe it does. But then the relationship of the old lady and the woman who's the same actress from the first movie, who is her daughter, but the old lady, whether it's through dementia or who knows what, like, sees her as an enemy and either doesn't remember that she's her daughter or refuses to acknowledge it. I'm like, I feel like there's something there. And I kept thinking about it, turning it over. And I'm like, I'm not exactly sure. Yeah. It's a fascinating dynamic. It does like play into like the danger that Amy is in for a brief moment at the end.
I think that was something that I would have really liked to see explore further, because
I would really have loved another scene or two.
Right.
With that dynamic.
I like horror that is about things that are actually real and horrifying, right? A ghost is fine. Like, The Shining isn't scary because it's a haunted house. The Shining is scary because it's an abusive husband and father who this wife and child are trapped in the house with. And that's kind of like the deeper existential horror that everything else gets to metaphorically attach to. And so I thought, you know, when this first scene came up, I thought that's what this was going to be like, because it's an adult woman living with her elderly mother who doesn't recognize her anymore and says, "You're not my child." And she's like, I am. And that to me is real life horror of, like, you know, watching.
Yeah, that was, those were definitely the most tense scenes. Like, that was uncomfortable.
It's unbelievably sad and terrifying to think that this person that you love so much could just be here but not be here, be gone, and that, you know, you don't see recognition in their eyes one day. And maybe you even feel jealousy when, like, this thing you long for, she's down looking at the little girl and saying, like, oh, I like you the same way I, you know, presumably used to like my daughter. I was like, ooh, like, give me more of this. But then they kind of never did. So no, I would have feel loved- like that whole part was like, nah, let's add something scary.
I would have loved another scene or two, because these are so fast and efficient. I think they had small budgets and small windows of time to actually physically shoot the movies. But so the first time Amy goes to the house, she receives, like, the old lady ties a ring in a handkerchief, throws it out the window, and Amy gets it. And I mean, the implication is that maybe it's an heirloom or something. And the daughter sees that, like, she just gave this random little girl a ring. Like, one could project it into it. Like, maybe, like, this was something that she wanted or attached value to. Yeah. And she sees this random little girl get it. So right away, she's like, like, there's hostility and frustration, but it's not the little girl's fault.
Right.
She's just like, oh, thanks, lady.
Yeah.
Thanks for the ring.
But and you're mad at who you need to be mad at in a situation.
Yeah. And she goes back home. She's like, isn't this a cool ring? And they're like, where did you get that? She's like, oh, the creepy house. And like, no, we got to go back and give that back. And that's when,
like, was it a wishing ring? Was that the thing?
Yeah. So a wishing ring. She sees a picture of Arena that they still have, interestingly. And she's like, who's that? And they tell her, they don't tell her the whole story. They just, I think, tell her the name. And then one night, she, like, touches the ring and she conjures Arena right at the halfway. Arena doesn't appear until, like, almost the exact halfway point of the movie. I, like,
did
paused
she see
it and
the
looked
picture
at the time
before
stamp.
She conjured
she
her?
She did.
Okay.
She either saw the, no, she heard the name at least.
Okay. Yeah. Because I think
so she
was
says
like,
her name.
End.
So she okay. touches, well, that's later. The picture is a couple times. She touches the ring and says the name Arena. And then that's kind of what conjures her. The first time is like her being named. And I'm sure that that's just the storytelling device, like the power of, like, known and being known, and something that Arena didn't really get in her life. So she's kind of being invited in a way to kind of be back. It's like both Oliver and Alice in the first movie and in this, there's still no, like, bad blood exactly. It's not. No. Alice is not jealous. She wasn't really, like, a homewrecker-y type in the first movie. In this one, she's like, look, I'm not jealous, but, like, you're kind of obsessed. And it's not like, oh, yeah. I wish you'd stop thinking about her. But, like, guy, this is clearly not helpful for you. Like, we should probably move on together.
Right. I would not have been as cool as Alice.
I don't imagine. I was like, oh, wow, she's very, like, chill.
Move on.
Let's probably get rid of these pictures. And
yes,
but you also understand Oliver. It's like the complicated, like, I love this woman. I tried to help her. It was this big mess. Like, that doesn't get erased. So, like, what is a healthy connection to that? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's complicated.
It's very complicated.
Your ex-wife is a cat monster.
Yeah, so she sees the picture of her, conjures her, and then, like, Arena is just this beautiful, like, almost kind of like a fairy godmother-y type presence for her.
Yes.
They play games outside and only Amy can see her.
Oh, it's so magical.
It really is. Like, the music is like a Snow White or Cinderella Disney type thing. Like, it's very, very sweet and soothing.
I'm like, okay, so when's she gonna turn evil?
When's this gonna get weird?
Exactly, because I'm like, okay, you're invoking, like, the dead ex-wife that, like, died. She died angry at him. She stalked
The misunderstanding.
She stalked the woman who he was, like, leaving her for, And so, you know, I was like, curse of the cat people. It's going to be, you know, she's going to come back. Oh, no. She's invited her in. She's going to seem nice at first, and then she's going to, you know.
Well, and when she first comes on screen, it's this, like, big moment.
Yeah.
And Amy talks to her and basically says, like, who are you? Like, what are you? What is this? And I wrote it down. Arena says, I come from great darkness and deep peace. Like, the just the contradictions of humanity that, like, have to live in tension together. I was like,
yeah,
this movie, like it's so good.
But that's a beautiful, like, summation of death, right?
Yeah.
Darkness and peace. I mean, that's
especially her route
right,
to death
right,
was brutal. She had a hard time in life.
Yeah. And I mean, she just is, it's really beautiful and, like, pure. She never turns bad.
Oliver sees her playing and he's like, what are you doing? And she's like, oh, I'm playing with my friend Arena. And he's like, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, the lady in the picture. Like, she's my friend.
Yeah.
And he kind of loses his mind. And that's the scene right before the spanking where Oliver basically says.
On Christmas, yeah?
Yeah, they were opening presents and she goes outside to give Arena a present. That's like her nicest present, that little brooch or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And Oliver's like, you need to say that there's nobody there or else yeah. I'm going to have to like do something drastic. And she's like, no, Dad. Like, she chooses to tell the truth and then gets punished and has her relationship with her dad kind of not severed, but altered. Like, that was such a hard scene. That was pretty horrific.
Yeah. For me too. That was a hard and yet beautiful scene, because that's another time where I feel like children so often are told, children are punished for telling their truth. Children, it's not just lying, that's children are punished for telling the truth about themselves, about how they feel, about what they see in their family dynamic. And if it's something that a parent doesn't want to hear, the children are often punished for that. And I think there's something so beautiful about a child saying it anyway.
I love you know? That moment.
Yeah.
It was so powerful.
Yeah. She's like, I'm not going to, like, surrender my integrity, even though I really do want to be the good girl that pleases you. I'm not going to do it this way by, like, looking.
She's like, no, Dad, like, I'm experiencing this right now.
Yeah.
And because it didn't square with Oliver's understanding or his temperament. And you even get an idea of, and I wrote this down. There's another, he goes back to the teacher one more time just to kind of, like, bounce stuff off her and, like, try to work with it. But, like, he is trying. I don't even know if he's trying. He wants her to just kind of be on his level, but he's not really making a lot of effort to understand her. Like, even Alice calls him on that. She's like, did you listen to her? And he's like, well, no, it doesn't make sense. He's like, well, it sounds like you didn't listen to her. Like, it sounds like you didn't hear her out and take her seriously. Like, Alice calls him on that. And then when Oliver has his second parent-teacher conference, I wrote it down again and I was like, man, this is the 40s. She was going hard. The teacher says, you design ships. That's your business. You don't have any qualifications to understand children. Like, that's my job.
Yeah.
Like, I studied. I'm a teacher. I've studied children for years. Like, you're just an engineer. You don't know. You have a child. That doesn't make you inherently good at this. This is something you're going to have to work on, and I can help you if you'll listen to me. And I was like, this was 80 years ago, like in like a seemingly like a junky genre B movie. I was like,
he's right.
This is like deep stuff.
So good. It's
like
so good.
Countercultural deep stuff.
Yeah. And she's responding to him because didn't he be like, what do you know? You don't have any kids. And she's like, why would having a kid make me qualified to have a kid?
Yeah. The biological act of having a child is not essential to like understanding and personal growth. And it seems like, your profession, what you have spent your energy on mastering is not the understanding of childhood development. Mine is. And like, if you listen to me, I can help you. And I was like, dang.
That was really good. Yeah. Yeah, that was good.
So then it kind of shifts again back to the old lady in the house and her daughter because Amy runs away and the old lady finds her.
She runs away because he takes her upstairs in this like really dark, like walking up the stairs one thing time, step at a time. And we don't see it, but like to spank her, to hit her.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that, like you said, the bond is kind of like broken or altered, and she runs away into like the snowy Christmas night, and they don't know where she is. She goes.
Yeah, this is a Christmas movie. They're like singing songs, and she's running away in the snow by herself, kind of with no direction. And you're like,
terrified and heartbroken.
Is this kid gonna like freeze and die outside? Like, what's gonna happen here?
Right, right.
And then she also, that's where she has like the little jump scare of the Headless Horseman story, but then it's just a car or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So she makes a way to the old lady's house. Mm-hmm. The old lady helps her. She's going to be safe and warm or whatever. But then the old lady just straight up dies.
She just dies going up the stairs. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, well, we got it. We got to keep this running. But you get that this old lady is not well.
No.
But then you have the daughter there. And that's the other real threat of the movie. The daughter looks like she's about to like strangle Amy, and she Amy ends up saying, she calls Arena my friend, and then she sees, I don't know, like that's maybe where the cat people, you could say, connection again a little bit, because Arena and this woman, like Amy sees, and kind of a cool visual effect for the time, like she's like, it kind of goes back and forth between Arena's face,
like projects
the face
her
of the daughter.
Her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like she calls her my friend in real time. And like that act of just even verbally, like that love, that acceptance, that warmth ends up like.
You kind of see like her hands going
dissolving
around.
Dissolving like, the hostility. Yeah. It looks like she's about to strangle the life out of her. But
then
she's saying
her.
Yeah. She's saying my friend, like in an accepting way. And it kind of diffuses that situation. And it's so impressive how all these like deep themes. I was like, okay, cat people. Wow, that was good. Curse of the Cat People. That can't be any good. And I was like, I really love this one too.
Yeah. I do. I feel like they're very different for me, but it's the fact that they're so different makes it kind of fun to go through and find the parallels, right? Like you have to sit with it, like you said, a little bit longer.
Well, in the arc, so Oliver's arc, because I mean, obviously this is Amy's movie, and you could potentially be cynical about the ending, but Oliver's arc at the end is when Amy is engaging with Arena. He's like, do you see Arena there? And she's like, yeah, she's right there. And Oliver's like, oh, that's great. I see her too. And just making that gesture to his daughter that like, I'm here with you. Like, it's okay to be who you are. Like, I'm in this with you.
Yeah. Because he's terrified that night because they don't know where she is. She does go out in the...
And he realizes, like, say it again.
Doesn't she go out in the snow again? Or, like, is she found at that house?
So she's found at that house and then they take her home. But he knows, like, she ran away because of what happened.
I could have lost
her.
Right.
He is responsible. He's like, oh man, like me acting out that way out of fear and anxiety that I'm clearly projecting on her. Like, that had an effect that like as a parent, like your kid goes missing out in the snow. You're like, my kid could have died because of my crap that I haven't possessed.
Right.
Like on whatever level he's kind of going and goes like, it's my fault. And my kid could have died. Like I need to get my crap together. And at the end of the movie, like he takes a step.
Absolutely. I think that that's also a somber and beautiful part of being a parent because, you know, I think all parents have those moments where you kind of stop and look at yourself with kind of this sinking feeling in your stomach being like, what did I just say? Or what did I just do? Or how did I just react? That's not the kind of parent that I want to be. That's not, you know, I've made them feel a way I wouldn't ever want them to feel. And then instead of just like getting so down on yourself, you go and repair, you know, and you go and, you know, apologize to your kid and repair the bond with your child. And it was like, again, I was like stunned at the end that I was like, oh, this is just like beautiful and wholesome. Like it's just, there's no catch. Like she's just an angel singing Serbian Christmas songs in the backyard and they're happy. It was really beautiful, but like not in a, I don't know. It wasn't in one of those so sweet that you're like, wait,
No.
It was genuinely a beautiful ending.
all the stuff lands because you can understand how the events of the first movie could create fear in Oliver. It's like, yes. There's this woman I loved who I couldn't help.
Yeah.
Like, he was so chill. Like, maybe he's even like, man, if I could have helped her, like, this is just me kind of thinking about the possibilities here. And that's one of the great things about these movies is that they're so sparse, is that they really do invite you to kind of put whatever it is into them. He could be like, man, this stuff happened to this woman who I loved. Like,
yeah.
Like, I wish I could have helped her, like, see reality, like, yeah. whatever. So he goes, okay, I see these things in my daughter. And he says it more than once, like, I feel like she could be Irena's daughter. And it's like, guy,
yeah.
You barely even kissed Irena, if you even kissed her. And then she died. Like, this isn't, yeah. I've read a couple reviews on Letterboxd. I feel like maybe if you watch it once, you're like, oh, was this Irena's daughter? And it's like, no, this was Alice's daughter.
No.
They say that explicitly in the movie, but
yeah.
In the first movie, the whole, it all wrapped around of like her issues around like sex and intimacy and all these things. Like, I don't even know if Oliver kissed her. Or no, he did. And then she's like, be careful. Like, and that's when she tells him the story. Like when they first are hanging out.
Oh,
like,
okay.
No, she says like, I want to kiss you. I don't think they kiss.
I think the only one that kisses her is the like creepy psychologist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, he's like, I want to kiss you. And then she's like, hey guy, like this is, and then on their wedding night, she's like, hey, I'm sorry. Be patient. He goes, yeah, I'll be patient. And maybe he'd be like, it was good in a way that he wasn't pushy, but I'm sure over the years, if he's kind of dwelling on that, he's like, well, what could I have done? Like,
yeah.
It's easy to kind of pendulum swing. Okay. Like I'm going to take more control. And he does that with his daughter. And it's like, this is a 6-year-old little girl who's still developing and understanding. And it's like with the mailbox, it's so beautiful and sweet. And in one of the commentary tracks, one of the people said that like that actually was taken from the producer's childhood. Like he had a tree in the backyard that he used to play with his parents, was like a magic mailbox. And just like, that's, you said, so how wholesome and sweet and beautiful, yeah. That is like,
yeah,
that was a fun thing. And she, because of that innocence and that sweetness, there were social repercussions because she didn't realize that you can't send birthday invitations in the tree. So he's like, I need to like stomp this out of her. Like, because she's not going to be well adjusted. And it's like, no, man, like that's some of your issues. Like, yeah, some of these kids are going to be mean. It would be cool if they weren't, but that doesn't mean you need to micromanage and be aggressive with your kid about like this, like non-existent standard of like being
what you're afraid of. Kid. Yeah. Yeah. I think that is another parallel, I think, is between the first movie and the second movie, is that the fear lives inside of us, right? There isn't really an external threat for most of either of the movies. It's kind of like a paranoia that builds up in one of the characters. In the first one, it's Irena. And in the second one, it's Oliver. It's like, you have the opportunity to release this fear and be genuinely safe if you wanted to. But because you are building something up in your mind, you're allowing yourself to get terrified of something that there's no threat, you know, which is, again, a really cool and interesting way to go about making a horror movie.
Well, and in addition, I mean, it's probably, if you haven't watched the movie yet, I highly recommend you check this out. But the two voices of reason in the movie are Alice and the teacher, who are both women. And that was a little countercultural as well.
Yeah.
These women telling this man, hey, yeah, you're a professional engineer, but like, that doesn't mean you're good with kids. Listen to your kid.
Yeah.
Like, be gentle with her, engage with her where she's at.
Such a good point.
She just hit a kid because he crushed a butterfly. Like, that's not a reason to get upset, all these things. And then eventually at the end, his journey is that he goes from being primarily controlled by his like fear and anxiety, which, I mean, if you break down a lot of our issues, a lot of them do stem from like fear.
Yeah. Like,
and yeah. Whether the religious, spiritual, social, like whatever way you're raised in both of these movies plays into like those fears that can lead you down bad paths to bad results. Like, he elects to make a choice at the end to engage with his daughter and to affirm her and support her and just kind of, yeah, be with her where she's at. And you don't want to put too much into that, but just the idea of like listening to your kids, being with your kids. And this is a genre fantasy horror B movie that was made for nothing. They're like, just call it Curse of the Cat People and make a movie. And they made this like beautifully profound movie that's also set on Christmas. I imagine I'll probably return to this several Christmases. Like, I don't know if I'll exactly watch it every year, but I might try to make people watch this with me every year. I love this movie.
This is going to be on my seasonal rotation. I love a good like seasonal movie. And I love keeping them and saving them for the season that they belong to. There's something really nostalgic and special about that.
Yeah, I just happened to go into a local store and I found a 9 DVD set of all the movies that the producer at Cat People, Curse of the Cat People, and a bunch of others that they made during this run in the 40s. So I have like a whole box set now.
And like,
I think I'm going to be a little jealous. Pulling this out every Christmas.
Text me a picture of that. I want to copy you and find it.
I will. If I find one, I'll let you know. But yeah, these movies are wonderful. And we talked about this on the show before. There's so much power in just genre you can use like, oh, she's got an imaginary friend. It's the ghost of her dad's whatever. But like, you can tell a really important story.
Yeah.
Like these themes. Now as a parent, like they could be different if you're a child, but I mean, now as a parent, like this movie, like is challenging to like be present and try to be a better father. I didn't imagine that when I first pressed play on Curse of the Cat People, I would be reminded of the importance of being a good parent.
Yeah, exactly. A non-authoritarian parent who like isn't reactive. And I think it's so good when you're talking about leading with like fear and panic. We can't make good decisions or clear decisions when that's kind of like the motivator behind what we're doing. I think that we have to, like in all situations, but especially as parents, for our own inner child too, for our children and our inner child, it's so much better if we can just have non-judgmental observation of what's going on first, instead of immediately being like, I see this, I judge it as something bad or harmful or scary, and I need to immediately intervene. And the way that I need to intervene is by reestablishing my dominance over the entire situation and the little child. I need the little child to feel the same kind of anxiety and panic that I feel so that they can behave the way I want them to behave, right?
Or even like, we were both raised in pretty conservative Christian religious cultures. Like,
yeah,
I even see people like talking to kids about stuff that kids don't even know about, like being overly corrective, where it's like, you're not being like explicitly correct, child. Like, let me correct you about,
like, what do you mean?
This. No, just like when kids say silly stuff, sometimes I'll see people be like, no, it's this. And I'm like, you do want to train kids. Like, if a kid was like 10 and they like said the wrong thing or like kept being like, just like silly little, just relationally, I've seen it where like a kid will say something silly and the adults will be like, no, it's this. And I'm like, okay, right, guys, like that desire, right, to like be certain and like perfectly correct. It's like the fact that your kid says this guy's orange, like that's not a problem. Like,
right.
No, it's blue. It's like, okay, yeah, they're like 4. What do you hope to accomplish?
Oh, I just definitely feel like that way. I'm like, let my 4-year-old say the word the adorable wrong way as long as he will. Like, he's going to learn to say the sentence in the right way. Don't rush.
My wife and I do that all the time. Sometimes I'll catch myself and I'm like, no, like we got a 5-year-old and a 2, almost 3-year-old. And they both will sometimes say words cute. And like, sometimes I'll go to correct them. And I'm like, man, this is such a precious time. Like,
yeah,
I don't want to miss out on that. And then I also don't want to be like that dad going like, rah, 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 you're not correct. And in order for me to accept you and to love you, you need to be correct. Like,
yeah,
I want to instruct them. Like, I don't want them when they're 15 to like say, like, you know, but it's appropriateness.
Right. And I think that there's always like a way to do that that isn't like shaming or controlling, right? Yeah. If they're 15,
leading with love, the same in the first one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Shame, and they're going to fear, learn.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I got so emotional when he asked me for avocado toast. And I was like, I'm never going to hear avocado toast again.
Those moments. My wife and I will look at each other sometimes when our kid who says like a word cute and wrong, like when we say it right, we're like, well, I guess that's gone now.
Yeah, but and the thing that you said about certainty, and like the importance of being right. Whew, like, that's another big one in the world that we came from, right? Is for a lot of people, if you get down to it, I think that they think that they're saved by believing the right things, right? So it's another kind of panic response, I think. If you really do think that your goodness and your standing with God and your eternal salvation is dependent on whether or not you are doctrinally correct, whether or not you have the right ideology, then yeah, you want to be like really heavy handed on making sure that your kid falls in line and repeats
mantras. If you're afraid that like damnation is on the other end of getting a thing wrong, like then that will lead to, if fear and anxiety and shame are the driving factors, that will like, in that system, in the fear, shame, anxiety system, like control is the thing that gets you where you're supposed to be safe.
Right.
And we see over and over and over like where that leads. And you look at the life and ministry of Jesus when he says stuff like my yoke is easy. My burden is light. Like let the children come to me. Like don't keep them away. And you see the way he like accepted people that society didn't accept. And it's like, how do we really want to be?
Yes. I think that for me, a big part of my turning in the way that I thought about my religion, and I know that deconstruction is a scary word, but I like to remind people that it just means to think critically about something, which is like what every Christian ought to do about their faith. But yeah, that was a big part. A big step in my deconstruction was thinking, okay, we have this imagery of God as a father. That's what Jesus says, that God is our parent, our heavenly parent. And now that I was a parent, it caused me to ask the question, what kind of parent is God? Is God the kind of parent with whom a child could form secure attachment, right? Or is God the kind of reactive parent where if their child gets it wrong, he's going to withhold his love and punish that child, right? Do I have to go? Do I have to figure it out and go to him and say, look, I've figured out that I'm going to, you know, do whatever you want me to do and serve you and give my life to you? Or does this parent continuously like make room for it to be safe in their presence, no matter what condition we are in? And I just, there was a moment where, you know, my child was having a hard time and I realized I'm 30 and my child is this little kid and I can hold it together. And I was calming my child down and I just thought, there's no way that I'm a better parent than God. There's no way. I have to be able to believe that if in some way we have this heavenly parent, that they are good. And so, you know, thinking about those metaphors and those allegories back and forth, I think is really important. It really matters. And I don't want to think about God as an abusive parent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All that from The Curse of the Cat People.
The Curse of the Cat People. Well, Philip, I think that maybe it's just us, though.
No. Well, and that's why I love this format. I love movies. I love talking about movies. But from the substantive cinema perspective, like I love looking at these things and seeing how what we can learn, and not what we can learn as if they're all teaching, but like it's any form of art. Like people look at movies as, oh, like this kind of entertainment, but really a good movie, like a genre movie, like a horror fantasy B movie thing, can be like affecting, like deeply affecting.
Yes, because if you engage with it. Archetypes, right? Archetypes, which are human experiences that are common to all humanity, right? This is why This is why we can connect to it. And this is why, like, pictures and parables and allegory and metaphor and poems and song are so valuable. That's another thing that I think evangelical Christians are kind of illiterate in how important they are. You know, there's kind of this idea that if something is not literal and...
Well, yeah, that's also the fear of engaging with those things.
Yeah, then it's not valuable, but it's not... That's not true. Again,
not at all.
Yeah, this is how we connect to the common human experience in a way that makes it bearable. Is through art.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I love this. I will be showing this to people for many years to come.
Yeah.
My son, my oldest, he heard me and my wife talk about it, and as I got our Cat People episode ready, he saw that I got it, and like he'll say to me. He goes, Dad, can I watch Cat People and the Curse of the Cat People? When can I watch those? Yeah, a little, definitely longer for Cat People. Curse of the Cat People, 5.
Oh, okay.
We're not quite ready for that.
Yeah.
But Curse of the Cat People, maybe. I don't know.
It's amazing how much like stuff goes over your head when you're a kid, though. He wouldn't have any idea what they're talking about.
That's true.
Yeah.
But I feel like the first one is actually a little bit like scarier.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The pool scene, you got
to. Yeah. I don't want to give him nightmares. Before we get, I'd love to hear a book update. But before we get to that, any shout outs? What have you been enjoying over the holiday season? What have you been watching? What have you been reading? What have you been listening to? Anything? By the time this comes out, the holiday season will pretty much be at an end. But what is the Stalvey household? What have you been enjoying lately here that's been edifying, encouraging, or just what have you been enjoying?
Well, this assumes that I have free time, which is funny. No, I'm working a lot on my book recently, so a lot of my extra time is just spent like illustrating and writing. And then I'm a full-time teacher and I've got a 4-year-old.
It's a lot of jobs.
So yeah, no, it's a lot of jobs. Anything that's on TV is just, it's Pixar movies at this point, which
highly substantive.
Actually, like, really enjoyed like watching it. Like Tommy's at the age where, you know, it's no longer like Blippi and Paw Patrol and stuff. And now it's Pixar movies. And I get to watch them again and again and again. And some of them are really good.
You do get
good.
Very familiar with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Like some of them are genuinely funny. Like Bug's Life is really funny. And I had forgotten about that movie entirely. It's so underrated. Have you ever seen Bug's Life?
Of course. I mean, I saw it in the theater and then a ton of times. And I mean, we've got it, but I haven't watched it in probably 15 years or more.
Exactly. Me neither. Since like 1998. And
maybe even 20 years. Like I watched it a ton. Like I saw it in the theater. Then we bought it on VHS and DVD. And I watched it a bunch like when I was a kid. But I haven't watched it in a very long time.
Me and my husband were just laughing to each other because we're like, this movie is just like Karl Marx. This is just, this movie is just like the answer that the workers unionizing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Groundhoppers.
It's really funny. He has like an entire like speech at the end where he's like, you don't, or, you know, we don't need you, you need us. And then
I just got the 4K that I wonder what it's going to look like because it was so old, but I should revisit that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. So all the Pixar movies are fun. I'm trying to think what I've like actually been reading. First Second had a book come out, a graphic novel, Guest in the House, which I think you might like. It's like a horror comic, but it's not like grotesque. It's a haunted house, second wife haunted by the ex-wife of her new husband, which, you know, it's interesting. It's a
is
little
this
bit
a memoir or is this a...
No, 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 it's just like, it's a fiction.
I'm pretty sure I've seen that at the library. I haven't picked it up yet. I might go
check
that out.
Yeah, it just like came out like really recently and I read it all in one sitting. It was super good.
I love those books.
Yeah.
You just can't stop.
Devour them. Yeah. Let's see. I think the last like full book that I finished cover to cover was a few months ago. It was The Dark Dark by Samantha Hunt. And it's a series of short stories that again are like, they're really interesting because they kind of like teeter on the edge of like, is this horror? Is this not? They're really interesting. They're psychological. Yeah. I think that I can't think of anything that I'm
no, that's good. I'll
really watching right now.
I'll put those out. That the guest in the house, I'm pretty sure I just saw that in the new section at the library. I'll check that out.
Yeah.
But really book cool. update, how's, I know you're with For a Second now, working on Pure. Yeah. How's that going?
Yeah, it's official. It's so great. It's so exciting. It's right now just like really trying to weave the narrative together. And even though it's an entirely different kind of book, it's a lot of the themes that we've been talking about together tonight, which is like the overlap between how like the things we absorb when we're young, kind of like manifest when we're older, and then how we get a new perspective on it when we become parents, right? That like gives us the opportunity to reevaluate our own childhood in a lot of ways. So it's like, if you guys are familiar with my work, it's has that like black and white look, and it like mostly takes place when I'm in like a college age. But then the actual storyline is going to alternate back and forth between like a present tense that's in color and then a black and white. And I'm trying to like knit it all together right
now. Love it when books do that. Love it when yeah. books do that.
Yeah. It's fun. It's cool. It's developing. So it's supposed to come out exactly 2 years from now, which sounds like a really long time, but I hope everybody can be patient for January 26th.
That'll be very exciting, I'm sure. If we're still doing the show, have you back, celebrate on that one.
Oh, you got to still be doing the show. You got to do it.
Well, excellent. Stephanie, thank you for coming back again. I'm so glad that I discovered these movies and that I found somebody that I thought they would resonate and that I was correct. I'm glad that
you're right on the money.
We found these movies.
Yeah, I just really enjoy talking to you about them. This is so much fun.
Well, you're welcome back. I'm excited. Whenever you're done with a proof copy, I'd love to check it out. If you want a blurb for the cover from a variety podcast host, I'd be happy to put one out there.
That's so kind. Thank you. Absolutely.
But yeah, thank you for this. This was great. I love these movies, listeners. I will be, because these movies are so old, there's actually a really nice high resolution version for free online. So if you don't have it from your local library, I'll put the link in the show notes. Go check it out. I've probably already said that in the intro so that you can watch it before you listen to this. But if you want to share it with anybody, there's a really nice edition on the Internet Archive, like a 1080p ripped from the Blu-ray that looks really nice. So check it out. Share it up. Let's rediscover and reclaim cat people and the curse of the cat people.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, have a good night, Stephanie. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. Have a great night. Thank you so much for having me.
There you have it. That was my conversation with artist Stephanie Stalvey on 1944's The Curse of the Cat People. Guess I just got to say thank you to Josh Larson and his book Fear Not. If I remember, I'll put that in the show notes as well. This whole journey, the Val Lewton Cat People, Curse of the Cat People, this all started with preparing to have him back on the show to talk about his book Fear Not. And I've just been introduced to a new world of the classic horror cinema because of that. And that's been great. So thank you, Josh. It's a wonderful book. Check out the book, check out that episode. But yeah, I love this movie. I don't think I like it more than the original, but the more I think about it, the more I watch it, which is very easy to do because it's like 70 minutes, the more I really love this movie. So hope you guys enjoyed the conversation. Check it out. The movie is in the show notes. Share it with your friends. Yeah, they're so well made and they're enjoyable on their face, and there's a lot to think about and to really engage with conversationally and personally, kind of in the wake of these. So great genre movies. Check these out. Like I said at the top of the show, if you like the show, the best way you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating or sharing the show with your friends. Text it, post it on your social media. We always love seeing that. And if you want to join us in support, you can do that. We have a Patreon where patrons of the show get exclusive content, get early interviews from editor Dave's Substack. He's got some great folks on there. Substance patrons get early access to that and getting to vote and influence the topics of future shows. So if you like the show, want to support, want to join us, for as little as $3 a month, you can do that in the show notes. We'd encourage you to sign up there. And if you want to send us a little gift and monthly support is not really your thing, not something you're financially able to do or interested in doing, you can drop us a little tip over at Cash App at $TheSubstancePod. And we'd also just love to hear from you. If you want to send us an email or a voice note, you can do that at thesubstancepod@gmail.com. If you have suggestions for topics, corrections, things like that, or if you just want to send us a little message and maybe get played on the show, you can send an audio or a voice note there, and we would love to hear from you. So I've been your host, Philip Marinello, and we will see you next time on The Substance. So, Curse of the Cat People. Say pause for editing here. How would we... Let me read the description here, and then we'll get into it.
Yeah.
Should have had this pulled up.
You're good.
See the video. It's going to be great outtakes here. Okay. Okay, the synopsis for a court... Try that again there. Watching this movie as a parent, I'm sure... is a completely different experience than if I watched it 5 or 6 years ago before I had a kid.
All movies are that way.
With, like,